We return to the record for closing remarks. We'll hear from the appellant first.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. I want to mainly focus on the CEPA issue, which we think is going to be determinative here. As you indicated in some of your questioning of the witnesses, when a determination of significance is issued, that's a determination by the city here that there are probable significant adverse environmental impacts associated with the project. And if you look at Exhibit 89, that's exactly what that document says. It's a determination of significance, and it identifies a host of areas of the environment that for which probable significant impacts have been identified. There's no running away from that by the city. I think some of their testimony today was an attempt to disavow that, to say that somebody made us do it. We wouldn't have written it that way or something like that. That's their official CEPA document. It says probable significant adverse impacts have been identified with regard to this project in the areas that are enumerated on that list, which, as you know, includes light and transportation. And so then the next step of the analysis is simply to determine whether the 0305 EIS provides an adequate analysis of those impacts. And it's a fairly easy issue to resolve because there's virtually no analysis in the 0305 EIS of the impacts of this building. That, and it's understandable because that was not the purpose of that EIS. That was a programmatic EIS for a large area. It broad brush approach, and it was not making an effort to identify impacts associated with building on the particular parcel here, or the impacts I would have on adjacent parcels. And so it's no surprise that both with regard to the two issues we focused on the most, the impact of daylight in the Scala units, the impacts on the alley, that there's zero analysis of that in the EIS. And as a result, given that the agency has determined that there are significant impacts in these arenas, and the impacts of this particular project aren't analyzed in that earlier EIS, it should be a fairly straightforward conclusion that the EIS is not adequate for this specific project. The problems get worse from there, frankly. Even if you were to look, in addition to those problems, that it doesn't analyze the impacts, an EIS, of course, is supposed to look at alternatives. The alternatives that were analyzed in the programmatic EIS were relevant to a programmatic EIS. They weren't particularly relevant to a project-specific EIS. They weren't relevant at all to a project-specific EIS, where the alternatives could have looked at alternative designs for this project and evaluated alternative designs' impacts on the alley, on traffic, on daylight, and other issues as well, shadows and everything else. The alternatives in the EIS that was essentially adopted by reference here simply didn't provide any alternative analysis at all. Because the EIS didn't identify the specific impacts from this project, it didn't look at specific mitigation for those impacts because they weren't identified. A lesser known element of an EIS is there's supposed to be a statement of unavoidable impacts. The impacts that have been identified and can't be mitigated are supposed to be listed. No list of those specific to this project. If the if the city had done it right here, it would have been fine for them to have adopted the EIS for some high-level gloss, but the specifics should have been analyzed in a supplemental EIS, if not an entirely new EIS. If they had done that, they would have gone through the proper process of scoping, public comments, comments from other agencies. None of that, or I should say all of that, was missed because of the process the city used. The EIS that they adopted also has another flaw in terms of being used, what, close to 15 years later now, and which is that the baseline conditions described in the EIS are no longer valid. The EIS, and that can be seen in a couple of ways, but perhaps most notably by reference to Exhibit 34, where we presented the data from the EIS in terms of the number of residential units that were anticipated to be developed under the alternative being analyzed there, and compared that with the actual number of units that have been built just up till, or in the pipeline, just up to a short time ago. And the actuals are, in one zone, about twice what they were using as for their forecast for where we would be at this time, and in the other zone, almost five times higher. The actuals are almost five times higher. There was a slight overstatement in our numbers in that graph that or in that chart that Mr. Tillman acknowledged because he had included the hotel rooms in addition to residential. So I think the exhibit says it's 2.5 times greater in one zone and five times greater in the other. Numbers are probably more like 2.3 and 4.8, but still massively more growth in the area than was anticipated in that EIS. And then that old EIS is also out of date because it doesn't anticipate all the additional growth that's yet to come, but that we know about now. So for instance, the boom in South Lake Union is not over. The increase in delivery truck, personalized delivery trucks is swelling traffic counts. The closing of the tunnel is going to, and the people avoiding the tolls on the tunnel starting next year are going to put more traffic on downtown roads. And probably maybe most importantly, the MHA, there's a whole nother up zone that has recently been adopted that's going to increase background traffic even more. We're not saying this EIS is the place to analyze MHA, for instance, or analyze the impacts of closing the tunnel. What we're saying is that in analyzing the impacts of this project, you have to start with a proper baseline. You need to know what the background condition is for the traffic patterns. And the background condition for the traffic patterns today is very different, and not just today, but in the very foreseeable future as MHA unfolds and the tunnel closes and all that, very different than what the background condition was in 03-05, or even what the 03-05 document forecast would be the condition today. So for all those reasons, and others that we'll detail in the written statement, we think the environmental impact statement adoption by the city is improper. They shortchanged the SEPA process, and that really can be the beginning and end of the analysis, because you don't reach, if you determine that an EIS is required, that's the end. You can remand it at that point for preparation of the EIS. I don't think you reach the substantive issues. The one other procedural issue related to the SEPA, though, that I wanted to mention was the timing of the SEPA review that was done here vis-a-vis the Design Review Board's recommendation of a specific design for this project, because you probably know that there's a lot of language throughout the SEPA statute and rules that SEPA is supposed to be completed as early in the process as possible so that it can inform decisions. And there are cases that talk about making sure it is done before projects develop unstoppable momentum and this sort of a thing. And here you had the whole design review board process being completed and basically the design of the project being fixed by the Design Review Board prior to the city completing its environmental review process. And I was frankly surprised to hear the testimony today that basically said that the city's process is such that they don't want the Design Review Board to consider the information coming out of the environmental review process, which is just a surprising testimony to hear. I understand that the Design Review Board doesn't pass judgment on the adequacy of an EIS or SEPA. We're not suggesting they should pass judgment on the adequacy of those documents, but they are supposed to make their decisions based on the environmental information. That SEPA says environmental information is supposed to be collected and provided to those making recommendations and decisions so they can have it. And so that, as you heard in one of my questions today, as the Design Review Board is contemplating the advantages or disadvantages of various designs, they should be considering, they have to be considering under SEPA, not just whether the design they're pushing or pushing against, not just whether it, how well it meets the design guidelines, they have to be cognizant of the environmental impacts of what they're doing. That's SEPA is an overlay statute, and it mandates that the people making decisions and recommendations not be blind to the environmental consequences of their recommendations and decisions. And yet the city admits today in their testimony that that's exactly what they do. They've created a process where they separate the Design Review Board from the environmental analysis that's being developed and force the Design Review Board to make a decision in a vacuum as to what the design of the building should be. With, I asked, so blind to the SEPA review? Yes, we don't want them to look at that. And that's a blatant violation of the law. So I thank you for your time and your attentiveness, and I think all council would agree. The questions you've asked have been great, and I think we really appreciate it, and we're looking forward to being done with this matter.
And with that, I have a couple questions for you. You referenced Exhibit 89.
Yes.
And the statement that the city has made in their SEPA determination of significance. Inherently, the determination of significance is entwined with in my experience, the determination of significance is inherently entwined with the determination that there are significant impacts. What we heard is that the testimony from the city is that this is more a practice of theirs with certain large projects downtown to simply move forward with a determination of significance, so they go through the FEIS process. The only insight, aside from that testimony that we have in the record that I've found so far, is this notice. And the notice says that the city has determined that the reference proposals could have probable significant adverse environmental impacts under SEPA, and then they list the issues. It doesn't quite say that they will have probable significant adverse significant impacts. Is there any differentiation there, and do you care to comment on that?
So I want to make sure we're looking at the same document, because the document I'm looking at does not say could have. It says are likely to have probable significant adverse impacts. Are we looking at the same? Is that the paragraph that says pursuant to SMT?
We're not looking at the same document.
All right. So
I'm looking at the July 3rd, 2017 one.
Ah. I'm looking at...
And then the December 15, 2016 says likely to have... But I see what you're...
Yeah. So I'm referring to the December 15, 2016. It says are likely to have probable significant adverse impact. That's the wording of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
That is the trigger for an environmental impact statement.
Okay.
And that I thought was Exhibit 89. Oh, there's two notices.
They're both in it.
Steve, we should get them
right.
Exhibit numbers.
Right. We may do that.
So so what is, let me, I don't have the second notice handy. Can you get me that?
Well, you have a copy of that?
I can give you the copy of the
narrative. Can I take a look at that just for a second?
We'll, you know, all I can say on that is, I guess, two things. A, we will address that more in the written submission, but I would say that if they had made a determination that there are not significant impacts, this would be a DNS. That would be a determination of non-significance.
Okay.
That is not what this document is, and it's not what the original document is. And I guess I'll leave it at that for the
moment. Okay. Is you indicate discuss the design review for the design review board makes a recommendation. I don't know that this is the case or that we have anything or that we'll ever know the answer to this, but it is the design review decision cured if the director who made the decision did take into account SEPA?
Well, that's where
I don't know that we know that, and yet whether that happened here or not, but.
But even if it did, I'll just say even if, I don't think that would cure it because the director's decision is heavily influenced by the recommendation by the design review board, both in practice and I think by the terms of the ordinance. Yeah, the director is required to embrace the DRB's recommendation unless extenuating circumstances are present. And even without that regulatory push and direction, the case law firmly establishes that the SEPA analysis has to be done before any significant recommendation or decision is made, before, in the words of one of the cases, the project develops institutional momentum, I think. And the recommendation by the DRB clearly is, you know, crosses that threshold.
Okay. There was one item that I didn't ask counsel about before because I missed it in my notes, but I noticed it during the break, and you don't have to address this now, but in case anybody wants to address it in their closing, Exhibit 76 was the excerpt from the SEPA handbook. The language in there that's been highlighted is boxed, and there's been a lot of focus on any new significant adverse environmental impact. That's in section 2.73 and in that boxed area. What we haven't really touched on is, and I'll read the section, and this is about addendums and whether they should be used, and it says they can be used if additional information becomes available that does not change the analysis of likely significant impacts or alternatives in the original SEPA document. And I'll also, before I get to the question I'm looking to try to have addressed, is in the box, the addendum, addendums are not appropriate if changes or new information indicates any new significant adverse. We've had a focus on that, but it also says increased significant adverse impacts. So there hasn't been much testimony about those aspects that are not just new significant aspect and significant impacts entirely, but also whether there are increases in level of significance.
Well,
you can address that now or not.
I'll take the first shot at it. First of all, to recognize that this whole part about reusing an EIS from an earlier project or an earlier proposal, you know, is probably developed in a very different mindset than the one where it's being used here. That is, you know, if you think of a typical development proposal, maybe a subdivision, 30-lot subdivision with a particular layout, and it gets with, and an EIS is prepared for it, and then a new project comes in, it's got 32 lots and a few, you know, slightly different layout, and the question is, well, can this new proposal use the EIS for the old one? And if the layouts are sufficiently close, similar to each other, and the impacts are pretty similar, you might say, yeah, the significant impacts are about the same. You can adopt the EIS. There's some tweaks. You know, there's some fine refinements. It's going to be a little different. One wetland's going to be filled by 55 square feet instead of 42 square feet. So you can include that in the addendum. So in other words, if you read this in that light, you can see the addendum is to be used where the significant impacts are basically the same. So you can adopt the EIS, but they're not identical. So if you use the addendum to disclose the nuances, the minor differences, when you translate that to this situation, you know, you have a EIS that looks at a zoning ordinance, and then you try to use that EIS that's looking at a programmatic zoning ordinance and use it instead for a specific project. It's already an odd fit, I would submit, that this was not what the drafters of this rule had in mind. It's frankly more like a phased review situation or planned action, but they haven't used those techniques. So they're trying to fit this within the reuse of an EIS, and it doesn't quite fit. And so then the issue is, okay, your addendum can't get into any significant, can't take, their witness admitted, you can't use the addendum as a substitute for a supplemental EIS. So you can't use it to discuss significant impacts or, as you were just pointing out, increases in the significant impacts, or I would say significant increases in those impacts. Because if there was a significant impact and it increased a little bit, I would acknowledge you probably don't need to address that in a supplemental EIS. But if there's a significant increase in an impact, then that needs to be addressed in an EIS. So how does all that apply here? In large part, the reason why we focused on new versus increased is because as to the impacts we've spent a lot of time talking about, there wasn't any discussion at all in the earlier EIS. So it wasn't a question of that EIS talked about the alley impacts or talked about the loss of light in these units, but didn't recognize the full extent of it. And so there's a greater impact in the alley or a greater impact in the daylight of these units than was in that earlier EIS. It was more of an all or nothing thing. If that earlier EIS, one way to look at it is in terms of applying that increased language, if you broaden your scope of analysis and if you think about traffic more broadly, and you could say, okay, the earlier EIS looked at traffic impacts across the whole area and recognized there were some significant impacts, but the alley, you could say, is an increased impact. Increased traffic impact. It's a new alley impact, but you could also characterize it in the scope of transportation impacts more generally. This is an increase in the transportation impact. So it would fit into that. And similarly with the light, we were viewing it as a whole new impact, but if you want to take it in the realm of light and shading and other things like that, and you could say, well, they talked about some of the significant impacts, and this is an increase in the impacts. So you could characterize it that way. I think you end up in the same place, that it's not appropriate to use an addendum for these significant impacts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ripley.
I'll get started.
Applicant?
Thank you very much.
Are you going to be giving us some closing, Ms. Anderson? Did you decide how you wanted to proceed with that?
Depends on what Mr. McCullough says.
Okay. Fair enough.
Okay. Try not to be duplicative here. Mr. Examiner, I think we've come full circle here. You know, we started on the appellant side with a motion for summary judgment, and it raised a host of procedural issues about the EIS and the use of the addendum. And we raised the point in our response that, and I think this answers the examiner's question about the standard of review here, that one of them we need to focus on, that the distinction between the use of an addendum and a supplemental EIS turns on this question that you were just discussing. Is there a new significant adverse impact associated with the proposal for which the addendum is done that was not reviewed in the original EIS? That, we would say, and we'll address this in our briefing, is a particular standard of review in addition to the rule of reason that the examiner has to look at in determining, you know, where is that threshold as between the two. But we raised in our response the obligation on the part of the appellants to come forward with factual information to demonstrate this new significant adverse impact. And I say we've come full circle because appellants in their closing really don't focus on any significant impacts. I'm sure they will talk about it in their briefing, but really what they've come back to is made an argument to you again that they made in their summary judgment motion. It's a procedural argument, and it's one that turns, as your colloquy indicated, for example, on the scoping notices, the determination of significance issue, both in December and July. Thank you for asking the question, because I was going to highlight on that. The language is different between the two, likely versus could have. But if you look at the regulations at WAC 197.11.360, could have is the correct formulation. The city's position when they issue a DS is it's possible that there are significant adverse impacts, and here with this proposal, so we're going to issue a DS and we're going to study them. Now, what appellants are trying to do in focusing on the likely to have is to say this proposal, 5th and Virginia, is going to have a significant adverse impact in every single element of the environment that's listed here. And that's kind of how they prove their lighting case now, is to say, yeah, it's an admission. This is what council argued. It's an admission on the part of the city that there was a significant impact. Well, there's no such admission, Your Honor. Under the regulations, and more clearly, I think, under the July determination of significance, there's only an indication that there could be an impact in any of these areas, or perhaps all of them. So then it's left to the city in its process to determine, is there a significant impact or not? Now, I agree with Mr. Brickland that if the city were to reach the conclusion that a proposal had no significant impacts whatsoever, that a DNS or an MDNS would be appropriate. But it's also possible that the city can reach a conclusion with a given project, and projects of this scale, downtown, large projects, admittedly, that there are significant impacts in some areas that were studied in the 2005 EIS, say, in the area of traffic, but that there are not significant impacts in other areas, and that there are no new significant impacts that would trigger the need for an SEIS. And that's what happened here, and that's what the record in front of you shows. Oh, what appellants in closing suggest is, well, the baseline has changed. All these new actions. We've got the viaduct is coming down and the tunnel's coming in, and we've got MHA, and we've got all this growth in South Lake Union, and delivery services have changed. And they say that proves their case because the baseline has changed. But in order to prove their case, they need to show not that the baseline has changed. They need to show that there are new impacts from 5th and Virginia that weren't discussed in the earlier EIS. And John Shaw sat down with you, as did Mike Swenson, and went through the intersections themselves. I mean, that's where you figure it out, for example, levels of service at intersections in the area, and compared what's happening under the addendum for 5th and Virginia versus the 2005 EIS. And both of them concluded there's no new significant impact here. Even when you build in all of this other activity. But again, the burden is on appellants here. If the appellants want to suggest that there is some new significant impact from the new Alaskan Way Tunnel, or from South Lake Union, or from MHA, they have a transportation consultant. That transportation consultant can come in and do a study and refute what is in the addendum as to levels of service. Have not done that. You don't see that in front of you. So what they rely on instead is this conversation about the alley. And, we've gone back and forth. I'm not going to go. We will deal with this in our brief, obviously. 5th and Virginia will be adopting a dock management plan. We will respond to that. It is robust, I think. Perhaps it can be made even more so with some of the suggestions that the examiner has identified. And so we will be as creative as possible in addressing that. But fundamentally, I think the lesson was Mr. Shaw's, and that is that the alley serves a different purpose than city streets. It's not meant for vehicular circulation. It's meant to provide services. It's a low-speed environment. Obstructions and blockages are common in alleys. And so while there's no question that in an alley downtown, drivers or truck drivers may experience inconvenience, there's nothing here we've seen in the record that would say that the alley functioning for what it's supposed to be functioning for is somehow a significant impact. You could have, let's stop there. On the issue, I want to touch on daylighting for just a second, and just to make sure you have some things to think about in the next couple weeks. Mr. Loveland.
Thank you.
Mr. Loveland really fundamentally made no claim of health impacts. I mean, he had made a suggestion about impacts at one point, and he, under your questioning, he walked back from that. I mean, his fundamental point was that there should be more study. I mean, he admitted that he picked the DA model not because he thought that it was the best model. He admitted it's not the best model. He picked it just because the architects picked it. And then he made, admittedly, you heard today, no effort to make sure that he calibrated against the correct design of the project. As Mr. Mott said, and as Mr. Loveland admitted, he used the wrong design of the project. And no effort to understand the exterior facade, all of those issues. So, and he testified no effort to understand the population that he was studying. He admitted if people are outside walking, if they're walking to work, that can have an important effect on one's exposure to daylight. I mean, he was coming at it, I think, from, you might say, a very high epidemiological level, looking at large populations, but that's not what CEPA is about. CEPA is about, is there an impact here in a more localized area? And he made no real effort to understand in that area what that impact was going to be. So Christopher Meek, you heard, came up, and he identified all of the flaws of DA, that it emits hundreds of hours a year, and that, in fact, these hours that it emits, many of them, are in the very key period, you heard Mr. Loveland admit today, the key period in the early morning when this light is important, not in the model. Doesn't measure light in the correct location. It's not at eye level, it's at table level. It doesn't measure the right kind of light. Both experts agree on that part. And doesn't at all account for light below 300 lux. Now, I think it's important to know, as Mr. Meek said, under 300 lux, zero credit. Now, we heard Mr. Loveland say that, well, the important light for someone to see is light in the early morning, and light at about 200 to 250 lux in circadian light. Now, we have no evidence about circadian light. But what we know is that the model that Mr. Loveland used completely ignored light in the 200 to 250 lux range. No question about that in the record. And completely ignored light prior to 8 a.m., the very light he said was most important. I don't see, well, I'll stop. It's not possible to draw a conclusion from that. And I think that was the point that Mr. Meek made. And in response to the question you asked, he said that DA model cannot disclose impacts from the loss of daylight. So as I said to him, there are two issues here. One is the model doesn't serve this purpose, but trying to establish a connection to health effects, you can't do that. But even worse, the model, as it's been executed here, does not in any reliable way describe the daylight environment within these residential spaces. And that is manifestly established by this record. So there's no impacts in any of these areas. And I think what I want to leave the examiner with is what I started with, is that the burden is on the appellants here to demonstrate actual facts of the likelihood of a new significant adverse environmental impact. And they've asked for more studies, they've raised questions, this isn't good enough, we want to see more, but they have not met their burden of bringing to you these facts. And absent that, they can't make their case.
You care to comment on design review?
Yes. On the Which
I have a specific question, but I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to address on that. But my specific question is whether design review should or is informed by SEPA.
The design review, well, the final decision, as noted in the examiner's question, the action that the city's taken is an action by the director of SDCI. And appellants have, you know, alluded here to snowballing arguments and that sort of thing. But that is the action, and SEPA must be completed and was in this case before an action was taken. The Design Review Board is providing information, a recommendation to the director that informs that decision, just as the SEPA review does. But the Design Review Board is not making a decision. And in any event, the addendum, the first version of it, was actually complete in advance of the Design Review Board meeting. So ultimately, it's the director making the decision in this case, Mr. Examiner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson, do you have something to add?
I don't think I can add anything beyond. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Excellent. Counsel, thank you very much for your professionalism, your courtesy to each other and to the witnesses, and for a thorough vetting of the issues. I look forward to getting your closing on the 20th.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.